From News Talk 580 1059 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Now here's your host, Mark Kepler.
California's election results signal a shift toward more progressive public policies on everything from crime to taxes. It also ushered in new Democratic supermajorities in both houses of the California legislature. What are the public policy implications? We'll ask. John Myers, Sacramento Bureau Chief with the Los Angeles Times, and Marissa Lagos with the California Politics and Government Desk for KQED. California's 2016 election, political sea change or political mirage?
We'll also hear from Valley legislators Joaquin Arambula from Fresno, Adam Gray from Merced, and Rudy Salas from Bakersfield.
Additional funding for the Matty Report made possible by a grant from The Wonderful Company, harvesting health and happiness around the world. From the California Channel at the State Capitol and the Matty Institute, it's the Matty Report with Executive Director of the Matty Institute, Mark Kepler.
Welcome. Well, there was lots of talk, actually consternation, about the 17 propositions on the California ballot. When the smoke cleared, Californians seemed to have done a U-turn on some important public policy issues ranging from crime to taxes. So what are the implications? We're fortunate to have two insightful folks on state politics with us today, John Myers from the LA Times and Marissa Lagos from KQED. Welcome.
Thank you.
So, John, I'll start with you.
Yep.
Lots of big tax and spend issues on the ballot. There was a $9 billion bond for K-12. That passed. There was a tax extension on the wealthy. That passed. There was a $2 cigarette tax. That passed. And requiring voter approval for bonds, that didn't pass, which the governor didn't want that to pass. So what gives?
I don't know. I mean, Californians, I think Californians were somewhat in a generous mood, I guess, if you look at it that way, Mark, when you roll it down that way. I mean, most notable out of that would say were the two tax measures, the cigarette tax measure and the income tax measure. Let's take the income tax first, Prop 55. There was no...
The temporary tax,
right, which adds 12 years to a 6-year tax, which makes it an 18-year tax, if in fact that is temporary. But there was no well-funded opposition to that income tax. I think that was a big deal. And then on the tobacco tax, that was a very close race 4 years ago to raise the tobacco tax, and Big Tobacco won. This time they didn't win, and I think in large part because they had a well-funded yes on the tobacco tax campaign, mainly by Tom Steyer, big Democratic activist.
So it's money, money talks. I mean, interesting, look at the big pharma measure that they were fighting against in terms of drug prices. Big Pharma won. They knocked it back, and they spent $109 million.
But that's a different situation. That was a very confusing measure. There was a lot of uncertainty about its implications, and they spent more than I think anybody's ever spent on a ballot measure in California. So money does talk. But I think on the cigarette tax, it talked, you know, you don't have to maybe spend the same amount as tobacco companies, but when you match them $2 for $1 compared to 4 years ago, it works. I think people like taxing people who aren't themselves.
Right. I think it's a good, because the cigarette tax, 12% of Californians smoke, yeah. So it's getting a smaller and smaller group.
And the income tax is on the highest earners in California. You've got to have taxable income of about $250,000 for a single filer, $500,000 for a joint filer. That is not the biggest chunk of taxpayers in California. It's easier to tax them.
Don't tax me, tax the guy behind the tree. So let's talk about another proposition, the one legalizing recreational use of marijuana. You could argue that's a revenue issue as much as a cultural issue. But that same, a similar prop like that just a few years ago was turned down. This time it passed. Well, you know, what changed this time, Marissa?
I think culturally, you know, the narrative has shifted. We've seen other states legalize it. It's become a lot more sort of, even though marijuana on a medical basis has been legal for 2 decades, it's been accepted a little more, I think, in recent years. This one was very carefully crafted. Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom was behind it. There was a lot of money behind it. I think it was a more sort of mainstream measure, and they tried ahead of time in the way they wrote it to sort of curb a lot of the criticisms they got the last time around. But I think in general, it's just the narrative is shifting nationally on this issue. I think that, you know, with the Trump administration, we're not going to see a lot of laying off of those prosecutions. But if you look at what voters think, not just in California, but nationally, the attitude's just changed in recent years.
Money, though, driving this a little bit?
Well, I mean, I know. I think Marissa's exactly right. But let's talk about the money just briefly. Newsom was involved, but Sean Parker, the former co-president of, or president, I should say, of Facebook and the guy who founded Napster, put a lot of money into it. This was a road-tested ballot measure, unlike the one a few years ago They had had a million blue ribbon commissions and town halls and discussions. It was a 17,000 word document. And I think key to it also is that it has a tax structure for state tax money, local tax monies, if local jurisdictions allow pot shops to open up there. I think that is a big part too. Again, revenue helps get past
up
maybe
to,
some
up to
of
a billion
the
dollars. That Elliot was saying.
Yeah. Revenue and local control. They gave cities and counties the ability to essentially opt out of this in a lot of ways. And I think that that again headed off opposition. Law enforcement were the only big sort of pushback, and they didn't have the money to fight it.
Well let me ask John. Let me ask you this about the tough on crime measures that we saw in the 80s and 90s seem to have been voters seem to be turning away from those. You've got they passed criminal sentencing reform this year. They also placed some restrictions on ammunition sales. But then again, they didn't go for a repeal of the death penalty, and they actually wanted to speed up the death penalty. What's
well,
going on here?
I think I would take death penalty and set it to the side. I think most people you'll talk to will say that there are different issues for the voters there. There's a morality issue. There's a longer issue. People wrestle with it in their conscience differently. The expediting of the death penalty, one on the other hand, I think there could have been some confusion out there. But the two you've mentioned are really interesting. The gun measure, which kind of reaffirms what the legislature did last year about background checks for ammunition. Mm-hmm. And then Prop 57, which Marisa and I both covered, which I think is a really fascinating measure. Again, didn't have a big opposition campaign in terms of money. I mean, law enforcement was there, but they didn't have the money. And the governor's campaign about parole and rethinking parole and a second chance for people who aren't the most violent offenders, I think it's a really sweeping, long-range change in criminal justice in the state.
What message were the voters sending with those criminal justice measures?
I think we have seen a real embracing of sort of rejecting the tough-on-crime measures that did pass, you know, over the last two decades. There was
three strikes seems so many years ago.
And it was.
And,
and you know, it was not that long ago, though, that voters rejected the first attempt to reform that. And Jerry Brown was out front opposing that reform. And now he's embraced it. A lot of it had to do with crowding and prisons and money that we've been spending. But I think in general, you've seen successful reforms in years past that haven't led to the crime increase, at least from a lot of people's perspective. And so people are willing to embrace this and give people a second chance.
Okay. Well, when we come back, we're going to switch gears a little bit and talk about the Trump effect in California. That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. Democrats are in control of state government, and the Republicans are in control of the federal government. So what gives? What are the implications? We're talking with Marisa Lagos, who reports on state politics for KQED's California Politics and Government Desk, and John Myers, Sacramento Bureau Chief for the LA Times. So, Marisa, let me ask you, let's start with immigration, an issue, perhaps the key issue in the campaign. What are we likely to see going forward?
Well, the biggest thing that I think cities, counties, and even the entire state is bracing themselves for is attempts to cut funding based on the sanctuary policies that we have here in California. These are things like the Statewide Trust Act, which basically limit how much sheriffs are allowed to cooperate with federal immigration and customs enforcement over when they bring somebody into a jail. Maybe they're ready to release them, but they have an immigration hold. Do they hold that person? Do they not? And so basically the Trump administration and Republicans in Congress are threatening to cut off funding for these sanctuary jurisdictions. Whether they can do that, you know, I think is an open question. There's already law enforcement grants that the Obama administration and the Republican-controlled Congress have moved to restrict, but there's a lot of other areas of funding, obviously, both at the state and local level. And so they're gonna be pushing back hard on these, what they see as sort of, you know, weak on immigration policy.
There's lots of money involved here.
There's a lot of money, and I think it's, you know, it's important that you look at what local communities are going to do. The sanctuary issue is huge. And then you match it with what the state government's going to do. And we saw right out of the gate, very first day of the legislature in December, with Democratic leaders saying, we're going to fight, we're drawing a line. I mean, a key issue that they put on the table is taxpayer dollars to fund the legal services mm-hmm. in yeah. deportation hearings of those who are undocumented. I think that is a huge issue. I think the real question is, how much does the Trump administration do? How fast? And does California want to sit and wait or be proactive? If you look at the governor in his early comments, he says, let's wait and see. If you hear Democrats in the state capitol and maybe some in local communities, they're like a fight mentality. I think it's going to be interesting.
Right out of the blocks. Let's turn to another issue that's not that divisive, Obamacare. big issue in the campaign, implications for California.
Huge, absolutely huge.
$20 billion?
Yeah, $15 billion safely, maybe more. No state was more aggressive at implementing the Affordable Care Act than California. We have 5 million people who are covered with health care now who weren't before, most of those in Medi-Cal, which is health care for the working poor. But covered California, the state's health exchange also has a chunk of those people. Big implications. I think the real question is how fast does Washington act, since they've said they're going to repeal it, and then how many years and how long does California have to do something, money and policy-wise?
Will there be something in place when they repeal it?
Right. And I mean, it's interesting, though, because the biggest hit would be Medicare. Mm-hmm. And that is actually something that they have a lot of leeway in terms of changing the way they put that money to states. They want to change to a block grant system instead of these matching funds. That could be very harmful to California's budget. And that's not something that will necessarily impact the 2017-18 budget, but I think going forward it's going to be a big deal.
But they're talking about a block grant based on pre-Obamacare numbers, yes. Which is a big difference because there's 3.7 million Californians enrolled in Medi-Cal. So that could have some big financial implications. Let me ask you about another small issue, John, climate change. A small issue.
How much time you got?
Right. We've got about 30 seconds. No, seminal issue for the governor and the legislature. Yeah. What's going to happen?
I would put that one last of the other two, if for no other reason than California went its own way for a decade when the Bush administration was there and California wanted to be more aggressive. I think California can play offense more than defense on climate change. But yes, there are these efforts about clean burning plants, coal fire plants around the country. The Trump administration may roll that back. California may even again be on its own island on trying to advance
back to the future,
which is interesting. Yeah, given the fact that one of the governor's things that he plans to push next year is, or did before Trump, when I haven't talked to him since, but is this idea of sort of expanding our electric grid to include other Western states? If Trump is really pushing more coal or other dirty sources, is he going to still want to go that road? I don't know, but I do think that, to John's point, it has less sort of impact on the bottom line in California because we have already been doing it, and a lot of these issues are not necessarily tied to our state budget. However, clean energy is a huge sector, and so I think it'll be really interesting to see if this businessman wants to undercut something that offers more jobs now to Americans than coal does.
Yeah.
I was going to say, just on that point, here in December, Google announced that they are in 2017 going to be 100% renewable energy in their entire business plan everywhere they go. Governor was touting it here in early December. Again, back to the business versus environmental match here. And the governor, I think, is ready to take on the president-elect if that issue comes up.
Well, I want to ask you this, Marissa. What do you think the Trump presidency is going to have on the beleaguered Republican Party in California? Is it going to reinvigorate them or is it going to push them down even further?
I think it could actually have the latter effect. I mean, if you look at the voting numbers, if you look at the sort of where folks are at, whether they're Democrats or independents or even some Republicans in California, if these sorts of initiatives go through to really cut off funding to punish states like California, I don't know that that's going to help Republicans here. That said, there's a lot of safe Republican congressional districts where Democrats thought they might have made some leeway this year because of how unpopular Trump was, and they didn't get anywhere. So we'll see, but I don't think it looks good, for example, for the 2018 governor's race.
Yeah, so what do you think, John, about the Republican Party post-Trump?
I think it's going to be a tough time. I mean, look at this. Donald Trump got almost half the votes Hillary Clinton did in California. I think that's a very big hole to dig out of, especially for a state Republican Party that's been struggling.
Okay, we're going to talk a little bit about the new faces in state politics in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. We're talking with KQED's Marissa Lagos and John Myers from the LA Times about the November election. Well, John, the Democrats squeaked out a supermajority in both houses of the California legislature. Is it that super?
You know, this is the great debate, right? I mean, is it? I mean, let's say this at first. If this had been the old days when it took a two-thirds vote in both houses to pass a budget, this would be huge because you needed Republican votes. It was ostensibly bipartisan, good deference to Mr. Maddie in the name of this program, but it usually was contentious and a big, giant fight. Now the supermajority is a much smaller thing. I think there's some symbolism, but I do think in the early days of this legislative session, we've seen something fascinating. Democrats wanting to use the supermajority for an urgency bill. What's an urgency bill? A bill that takes effect immediately, becomes law immediately. An urgency on anti-Trump immigration policy, for example. That's a place where the supermajority, I think, has a little bit of power. Otherwise, it's a feel-good, I think, for Democrats.
Yeah, I mean, it's not going to be that much easier to convince moderate Democrats from, say, the Central Valley to support tax increases or maybe even, you know, crack down on oil consumption, as we've seen in years past. But it could make majority bills easier to get to, right? For very contentious issues, maybe things like law enforcement reform, where there's been a lot of it's been hard to get there to 41 in the Assembly in particular. So I don't think, yeah, we're going to see them go hog wild with taxes. Let's not forget Jerry Brown's still in the governor's office. But there are things that it's going to make a difference. And I think symbolically, they like it.
Well, let's talk about the mods for a little bit, those business-friendly Democrats. With the fading prospects of the California Republican Party, are they going to become the new opposition?
They have, I think. I mean, I think that's already happened. I think this is why it's so interesting to see where the party itself has decided to put its resources during recent elections, because a lot of times they're supporting Democrats that maybe voted with them less than some of the moderate Republicans they're trying to defeat. So, yes, I think that that's going to be a real big challenge, especially for the Speaker, Anthony Rendon, who just took, you know, his office last March. I think they've really played more in the Assembly in the last couple of years, but, you know, it remains to be seen. I think it'll be a challenge for Kevin DeLeon in the Senate as well.
The mods have an interesting role there. They're kind of like a third liberal Democrats, third these business Democrats, and a third Republicans. It seems like it kind of breaks down in a way, isn't it? I mean, they're playing an important role there.
Well, the first thing is, I mean, they call themselves the mods. I try to avoid that term a little bit because
You don't like mod squad?
Well, no, because, I mean, moderate to what? I mean, who's to the right of them in the Democratic Party? There's not anyone. They're business-aligned Democrats. They're focused on business and economic issues in a way that's different than Democratic Party orthodoxy. On social issues, they're lined up with other Democrats, I think. I think a key area to watch is going to be transportation at the beginning of this legislative session, because transportation stalled, I guess pun intended there, in 2016 because of a gas tax, which would take a two-thirds vote. And one of the leaders of the MOD caucus, Assemblyman Jim Cooper of Sacramento, I talked to on the very beginning of this, and he said, I don't know about that gas tax increase. It depends on how it's crafted. And that's, again, where you see these Democrats who are kind of averse to taxes are going to have to wrestle with the issues.
Yeah. But on that issue, it's interesting because one of the biggest proponents of some sort of transportation deal is the business community.
Right.
So do
right.
they listen to them? Is it more we're just sort of not comfortable with taxes? And like you said, I mean, he's not jumping on board, but he's saying, giving an opening to say it depends on how it's crafted, as opposed to Republicans who just say no taxes.
Now, there's an alliance there between the unions and companies who might want to see these transportation things move forward. Let me ask this, Marisa, about we have a new U.S. Senator from California, former California AG Kamala Harris. She's been replaced by Governor Brown by Xavier Becerra, new AG. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think this was an interesting and somewhat surprising choice for the governor, but a smart one. Becerra is going to be, if he's confirmed, the first Latino attorney general. He comes from D.C. after spending 24 years there, and so he understands the way that Congress functions. He understands potentially sort of what the Republican Congress and Trump are going to be doing to push back on some of the issues that we've discussed around California. And I think that he also is very well respected, well-known in Los Angeles, which is a huge population center, obviously. And he knows how to raise money. He's been in Congress for 2 decades. So,
what are your thoughts on the appointment?
There is almost no one who thinks that Xavier Becerra was a bad pick for Governor Brown, for the reasons that Marisa says, and for the simple fact
some folks in the Trump administration.
Well, but I was going to say, for the simple fact that he meets the goal of a lot of Democrats in two ways. One, he's the right face. He has the right story, a son of Mexican immigrants. And secondly, he knows the attorney general's office. He was a deputy attorney general to John Vandekamp before he was in the legislature and in Congress. And he may know how to work the levers of power. And an attorney general is a huge part of the fight if California is going to have it with the Trump administration.
Okay, when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about the future of California politics, new faces and whatnot. That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. So what does 2017 hold for California politics? We're talking with John Myers from the LA Times and Marisa Lagos from KQED. So, Marisa, Governor Brown, the legislature, what are the big issues you think they're going to be focusing on going forward?
Well, I think a lot of it's going to be pushing back against Trump and whatever he's going to be doing around immigration and some of the other issues we've discussed. I think also, you know, the budget is a big question mark this year after several years of sort of good budget news, given the uncertainty of the federal government. And
Governor Brown always warns about the finances.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think he's got a little bit more of a leg to stand on this year. And so, you know, I think, you know, watching what they decide to do around climate change, for example, mm-hmm. whether they decide to pursue cap and trade, speaking of a two-thirds majority legislation. And then, yeah, just I think everybody's sort of just getting ready for what could come from Washington. And I think that's really going to sort of overwhelm anything else this year in a way.
So worrying about the recession, worrying about the Trump effect in California, what it means in terms of the state budget, going to slow down initiatives?
I think it could slow down all kinds of things. I mean, the reality is that the state's finances, to Marisa's point, are looking very good. I mean, there's an early analysis that suggests maybe about $1 billion that could be spent. Do you commit that $1 billion, though, when you may have to start plugging some holes under a Trump administration? The other thing really quickly, Mark, I would point out is that I think Democrats are aware that this election cycle was a revolt of the middle class who voted for Trump, some who wanted to have Sanders early on. And so what programs are they going to pursue in Sacramento that are going to be focused on the middle class, not the poor and not the wealthy, but working class Californians? Do they need to have a conversation?
But could you argue that in California, where Hillary Clinton did much better than Donald Trump? I mean, it's true nationally.
Yeah, but I think no disrespect to Secretary Clinton's victory, but look at the dynamics of California already, where the Republican Party was already shrunk. Democrats already are ascendant. They have all of the statewide offices. All they hear from are Democrats in some ways.
Yeah, Marissa, let me ask you this. You know, Democrats now calling the shots in California. Of course, you got the congressional Republicans, Donald Trump. The Republicans clearly control the federal government. Some have suggested that California is going to take on Trump and the Republicans, kind of like what Texas did to Obama. So do you foresee California taking a Texas-sized approach?
I do, actually. I think we've already seen people say, don't mess with California, right? suddenly we love everything that Texas
does. We want to succeed, just like Texas always did, right?
I absolutely do, and I think, you know, the governor's pick for attorney general was sort of fighting words in that respect, that we are going to see lawsuits, say, if they try to strip money from the state because of the sanctuary policies or if they go after immigrants. You know, I think the Attorney General's office in many ways will lead that effort in court, and then we might see actually city attorneys and other folks at the local level follow suit.
So AG Becerra going to have a pretty important role here.
Yeah, I think absolutely. I mean, look at the Texas anecdote, right? The former Attorney General of Texas said, I'd get up in the morning, I sue Obama, I go home. I mean, that's what California can do. And isn't it fascinating, Mark, that we're flipping the discussion of states' rights versus federal government here? You know, California believed in a strong federal government when it was a Democratic White House, and now we're probably going to believe in a very strong states' rights system now that we are on the other end.
Absolutely. Actually, two of the cases that were brought to my attention when I was reporting out the issue of sanctuary funds and whether the federal government can actually take away money from jurisdictions over immigration policies was one case that was brought by sheriffs in rural Texas who didn't want to enforce some gun background check laws that the federal government had instated, and another one that was brought by a small business federation over Obamacare. And in both those cases, the high court said, you know what, you can punish jurisdictions to an extent, but you can't make them do your job, and you can't take away all their money just because they do one thing you don't like. And so I think it's going to be a fascinating embracing of those sort of red states values in a way.
John, let me ask you this. So winners and losers in 2016, how would you sum that up?
Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton. Winner, Jerry Brown. I think Jerry Brown won in 2016. I mean, he wasn't on the ballot, but legislatively prior to the election, I think he did pretty good in terms of what he wanted. He beat back Prop 53, which you mentioned at one point, which was
And that looked like it was going to pass.
Yeah, which would require a vote on revenue bonds, could have been trouble for high-speed rail or the Delta Water Project. Losers, I don't know. I think that in some environmental community folks may not have gotten what they wanted out of the Capitol prior to the election. And then the MODs, the business-aligned Democrats, are still pretty powerful. And that environmental Democrats versus business Democrats is a big, big fight in Sacramento.
Winners and losers?
Well, you know, I think Kamala Harris actually enters this administration with a really interesting role. I think that if she had come in under Hillary Clinton, she would have just been one of 50 and it would have been a different story. Now she has this chance to be a fighter, and I think you've already seen her meet with Elizabeth Warren. I think she has an opportunity to really make a mark that she wouldn't have had under a Democratic administration.
Well, I want to thank John Myers from the San Francisco Bureau of the LA Times and Mirza Lagos from KQED News for joining us. You also might want to catch their California Politics podcast each week. Very insightful.
Good plug. Thank you.
Yeah.
You're welcome. And if you want to keep up with state and local politics, you can also check out the Maddie Institute on Facebook, Twitter, or logging us onto our website at maddieinstitute.org.
Up next, what are the implications for the Valley? We'll talk to three state legislators from the Valley: Joaquin Arambula from Fresno, Adam Gray from Merced, and Rudy Salas from Bakersfield.
You're listening to the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition, on KMJ.
Welcome back. There's a lot of talk about the new Democratic supermajority in the California legislature, as well as what the MODs, a growing caucus within the Democratic majority, many with Valley ties, will mean for 2017. We're joined by three Democratic legislators from the Valley, Joaquin Arambula, a Democrat from Fresno. Welcome, Joaquin.
Thank you.
Assemblymember Adam Gray from Merced. Welcome, Assemblymember Gray.
Thanks so much.
And Assemblymember Rudy Salas from Bakersfield. Welcome, Assemblymember Salas.
Thank you. Thank you for having us on.
Well, thank you. But quick editor's note, we did invite Valley Republican Assembly members to join us to talk about the election results and the upcoming legislative agenda, but they were unable to join us. So, Assemblymember Salas, let me start with you. Wanted to get your thoughts on the November election. You know, we had those very large ballots, 17 propositions. What propositions do you think are going to have the biggest impact on the Valley?
Well, we know there was a lot of propositions on the ballot. I know some people, some voters were feeling a little bit of fatigue, but they were actually going through, and I know all the people I talked to door-to-door were actually asking specific questions about a lot of the ballots. I know, too, that I think will affect us in the Valley pretty significantly is probably Proposition 51. That's the school construction. That's the $9 billion that's used to not only $3 billion for new construction of new facilities, but it also provides $3 billion for the modernization of school facilities. And as you know, when you travel up and down the entire valley, you see some schools that need a little more, let's say, care and attention, I guess is a good way to say it. So there'll be some access to those funds. You know, additionally, they had some funding for charter schools and then also just for acquiring and constructing all of these schools and these facilities and those sites. The other one I think that will affect us too is Proposition 58, because no matter whether you're in a small community or a small town, or even if you're in a more urban area, was Proposition 58, the multilingual. Mm-hmm. And as we have a large influx of English learners, whether it's Spanish or whether in Fresno, I know you're in Fresno with the Hmong community, but it allows the local schools to have the flexibility to get those students to learn English a little bit quicker.
Right. That's a key point that there's local control there, right? I mean, they can decide, local districts, right, how they're going to implement that. Yeah, very, very interesting. And very important for the Valley, for sure. Senator Arambula, what are your thoughts on all those propositions on the November ballot and what some of them, what are the most important ones for the Valley?
So I first must say that I'm a bit troubled that there were so many propositions in front of voters this year. You know, I trust the electorate to make informed decisions, but struggle to see how one simple paragraph can explain some of the complex ideas that are being passed with these laws. You know, we have unintended consequences from many of these propositions that have concerns in the Valley. And so, you know, I think we need to first take a look at the propositions and make sure and question if that's the right medium in which to be passing significant legislation. But to answer your question directly, you know, I was fighting for Proposition 56. You know, I'm in healthcare,
and that's the $2 cigarette tax, correct?
It is, and you know, the idea behind it was we were the first state to pass it, and we have not adjusted it in over two decades. And We were now less than one-fifth of what they collect in states like New York, and that's the major mechanism that most places have to adequately fund their Medi-Cal, their access to health care. And coming from the Valley, representing a district like we do, you know, how we fund Medi-Cal, how we have access to care is important. And I was proud that the voters of the state were successful in passing that because I think it helps to align us with the rest of the nation so that we can appropriately fund our health care.
Let me ask you a quick follow-up on that. You know, the percentage of voters, smokers in California that are voters, smokers in California has been going down for a long time. I think it's about 12% of the general population in California. Are you concerned at all that this additional tax is going to maybe generate less money over time as fewer and fewer people smoke?
Most of these taxes, sin taxes as they are regressive in nature, right? They penalize you so that you have less people who are doing the action. I think the part that most excited me about the bill was actually that it expanded it to e-cigarettes or vaping.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we've started to actually take a look at the technology that has been created, when we passed the original proposition, that technology was not around.
Right.
And so we've need some adjustments to expand it to that industry, which particularly has taken effect to our teenagers. So that was something that I think will be exciting to see in the future.
Yeah, and I think just to reiterate your point you were making, that the number here, while it's a big bump from the original tax, it really the original cigarette tax was quite below a lot of other states. This kind of gets us on par with a lot of other states in terms of cigarette taxes.
So to be specific, we're at 87 cents. New right. York is at $4.35. So right. adding us actually gets us halfway to where they are. But
halfway there.
We're not even, you know.
Okay. And so I want to also ask Assemblymember Gray from Merced, what are your thoughts on the propositions? Anyone particularly going to be impactful here in the Valley?
Well, I think I'll, you know, echo both of my colleagues' comments in so much as I think, you know, Prop 51 and the investments, you know, the community colleges and our education system, probably the best thing that's going to have the best benefit for the Valley. But I also want to agree with Mr. Randall in the sense that, you know, I think the initiative system, doesn't necessarily benefit California, but more importantly, certainly doesn't benefit the Valley. Because what you have with the initiative system is the big urban population centers, LA and San Francisco, put on stuff that benefits them, and it's funded by special interests, and the Valley doesn't get a voice. Whereas in the legislature, when Joaquin and Rudy and myself and Anthony Canella and Andy Vidak and others can all work together like we do with the San Joaquin Valley Caucus in a bipartisan fashion to make sure that our region doesn't get left behind. I mean, as I go through these, you know, you guys were just talking about the cigarette tax, Prop 56. I mean, that was funded by special interests, and frankly, the way it was written benefits some of those special interests that funded it. Now, that doesn't say that it doesn't do good things. It does, but it could have been done better. You know, it's a diminishing source of revenue, and frankly, when you have a diminishing source of revenue, you ought to be making investments with that money for the long term. Well, what do I mean by that? Well, frankly, if we were going to do a big cigarette tax, you know, we probably ought to take some of that money and build healthcare facilities like UC Merced Medical School, you know, like nursing programs, and invest in things that actually bolster our healthcare infrastructure forever. Right?
Do you think some of those funds? Do you think Assemblymember Gray? Do you think some of those funds might be steered toward developing that medical school they've been talking about at UC Merced?
I don't think so. I think most of it will be steered toward, you know, a variety of nonprofits for education programs, and then some money into the healthcare company infrastructure, frankly. And, you know, some of that is good stuff. My point is it could have been written better had it been done to the legislature, and that applies to almost everything on here. And it's unfortunate, you know, that we have a system that we sell to the people as direct democracy, but the reality is unless you have $2 million in your pocket, you can't get something onto the ballot, nor can you fund a campaign to get it passed.
You know, the only thing
I feel like, Mark,
I'm sorry,
can I
ahead.
Jump in here
sure,
for
sure.
a second? You know, one that we haven't talked about that, you know, being a bit of an outsider myself coming into the building, you know, you never understand how much transparency and oversight there is in the legislature, and must admit that I was impressed with Prop 54 and feel that it will help to add to the public's awareness of what's transpiring within our
building. That was just for our listeners, that was requiring bills to be published 72 hours in advance before a vote. Correct?
You know, I think that will actually strengthen our institution to make sure that we're being deliberate and thoughtful in the way in which we legislate, and was excited that that was passed this year. You know, I disagree with the funding source of it. I wish it would have come from the general fund, but that's, you know, a small detail in the grand scheme of things.
You know, one of the things I think you also bring up, Assemblymember Arambula, is the unintended consequences, particularly with this budget from the ballot approach to things. Sometimes you don't realize that you think your A is going to happen, but then a few years later B happens. I think all of you have kind of mentioned that one way or another. So I think that's also something to think about when you look at these initiatives and propositions. You really don't know the long-term implications sometimes. Let me kind of switch gears a little bit here and talk about the new Democratic supermajority in both houses of the state legislature. You know, sometimes people think Democrats are a monolithic group, but that's really not true. Valley Democrats are quite different from Bay Area and LA area Democrats when it comes to a lot of issues that they deem important and well as the best ways to really address those issues. And so Assemblymember Salas from Bakersfield, you're one of the leaders of the MODS. What issues – the MODS, by the way, are those moderate Democrats work across the aisle. What issues do you see the legislature tackling in 2017, and what kinds of prescriptions will you be advocating on those issues?
Yeah, first let me just say we have a good group of Democrats that are like-minded that just want to talk about how are we fiscally prudent in the state? What are we doing to tackle unemployment? What are we doing to grow the economy in California? What are we doing, quite frankly, for places like here in the Valley where we know people are still struggling, and how are we giving them opportunities? And I can tell you that Assemblymember Gray and Arambula have been great advocates of that. So as we look to tackle some of these issues in 2017, you'll see us look at those issues, and whether that's looking at the STEM programs, for instance, you know, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. How are we preparing our students so that they meet what we hear from companies up and down the valley and across the entire state that are saying that they need more people with more technical skills? Right, and I think we have this notion in the Capitol where everybody's just going to go to college and that's it. But what we hear from all the businesses is, well, we need people that are trained, people that have these technical skills. So whether it's working a computer program at, say, like a Grimley or a Bolthouse or one of Boswell's companies are wonderful, you know, that they have those skills to do that. You know, the other thing that I'm hoping that we'll focus on, too, is some water infrastructure. Mm-hmm. We know that we still need to fix the pipe works here in the state. That's something that we still need to do. I think you'll see us focus on not only STEM, college, and getting people prepared for the workforce, but hopefully we'll get the governor to focus back on some water infrastructure, fixing the pipelines throughout the state. And then there's another thing that I want to look at, and that's the PAGA lawsuits. We know that there are attorneys from out of the area coming in and suing all kinds of businesses on what I would call some frivolous things that I'm hoping to get addressed.
Are those the disability claims that they're making? Are those disability lawsuits?
It's based off the disability ones and what they're doing. And for instance, we have one company here in the Valley that was sued because they gave Christmas bonuses to their employees. And the lawyers came in from out of the area and said, well, that should have been, you know, employee wages. And because you didn't classify it as such, we're going to sue you. And then they extract millions of dollars from these companies who were trying to do something good for their employees.
You hear a lot about that. You hear a lot about that in disability claims, where if an employer doesn't have a ramp or something like that, they end up getting sued, and these lawyers go from businesses to businesses suing them and trying to extract some kind of settlement out of them. So I think that sounds like what you're talking about.
Exactly. This is like the new form of that. And so I know, I believe Assemblymember Gray will probably touch upon this because it was Gray, Olson, and really your Valley folks that came together to even try to do a right to cure for some of those lawsuits as well.
Yeah. I want to get Assemblymember Gray and Assemblymember Rambula in here. What are the big issues, Assemblymember Gray, you're looking at in 2017?
You know, this probably won't come as a great surprise to your listeners because I've been on the station many times talking about water. And there's really got to be any issue, I think, more central to the Valley. We talk about, you know, the Valley Caucus and even the moderate Democrats, which obviously include all of the Valley Dems. You know, what we're seeing right now in my area is the Water Board continue to make, you know, irrational decisions in how we manage the flows, the unimpaired flows in our rivers. You know, we have got to, at some point in this state, not only make the water infrastructure investments that Assemblymember Salas referenced, but we have to start dealing with water in its entirety. What I mean by that is in the 4 years that Rudy and I have been in office and Joaquin's joined us here more recently, we passed a water bond. None of money, you know, that the voters approved that still hasn't gotten out the door to fund projects. We passed the Groundwater Sustainability Act. And then separate from both of those things, we've had Fish and Wildlife and the Water Board making decisions about how we do our flows in the rivers and how we deal with habitat protection and restoration. And we don't, none of these decisions are made together with each other in unison, in concert. And what you end up with then is the Water Board flushing more water down the river at the expense of our aquifers and our groundwater, right? You don't flood irrigate, therefore you compound subsidence and other really difficult issues that we're facing up and down the valley. So we got to start to figure out how do we protect our groundwater, protect our rivers, protect agriculture, and what does it take to get there?
Yeah.
Do we need to build some additional surface storage? I think we do. Do we need to make some investments in some additional groundwater projects? I think we do. But we got to get serious, and we got to have all the different agencies and commissions and boards actually talking to each other.
Yeah, a comprehensive
approach.
I really
hope that we can address that this year.
Yeah, you know, we've only got about a minute left in this segment. I wanted to ask Assemblymember Rambula, what are your thoughts on 2017? What are the big issues?
So maybe I'll just touch on the first bill that I'm going to introduce since I only have a minute and I've never publicly announced it thus far. But, you know, I've been asked by local leaders here to help support agriculture, and I'm planning to introduce legislation that will allow Fresno State to grant PhDs in ag education. I believe we need to start training more leaders in agriculture to start teaching the next generation of farmers the technology and innovations and how we can be creative. And so I want to help support an anchor institution here in the Valley with Fresno State by seeing if I can work to get a bill passed that would grant them the ability to pass the that degree.
Well, that's news. Thank you very much, Assemblymember Rambula, for announcing that on our program. Well, up next, we're going to talk about California's democratically led state government and the possibility of whether or not it's on a collision course with Republican led federal government. What are the implications for the Valley? That conversation in a moment. This is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition.
You're listening to the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition on KMJ.
Welcome back. We're talking with three state assembly members from the Valley, Assemblymember Joaquin Arambula from Fresno, Assemblymember Adam Gray from Merced, and Assemblymember Rudy Salas from Bakersfield. So Assemblymember Arambula, it's interesting, you know, in the earlier segment, we're talking with John Myers of the LA Times and Marissa Lagos from KQED, and we discussed this, you know, California as the new Texas 2.0, you know, where California is going to be to President Trump and congressional Republicans what Texas was to President Obama. You know, constantly battling the federal government on a range of issues. And I'm just wondering what you think, how the California legislature is going to respond or should respond to federal efforts maybe to change course on a lot of issues that are really important to the Valley, like immigration or Obamacare, you know, Medi-Cal implications and climate change. I mean, how do you think they will or should respond to some of these federal initiatives or changes?
I think most of us would agree that improvements in healthcare need to be made, and would want to work in a constructive way with the Trump administration to figure out what healthcare 2.0 looks like. I came from the healthcare industry and know that it's a system that could be improved and we can find efficiencies within it. I hope they're willing to listen to those of us who have practiced medicine and been on the front lines, because many of us will have some of the answers and solutions that may help us to design a better system moving forward.
Okay. Assemblymember Gray, what are your thoughts on this, this federal-state potential clash? Oh, I think we just lost him. So we'll go to Assemblymember Salas and wait for Assemblymember Gray to rejoin us. Assemblymember Salas, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, no, I think everyone's trying to wait to see after President Trump gets sworn in on January 20th. I think everything you're seeing in the media and what all the discussions are is, you know, what's rhetoric? What's he going to follow through with? I know some of the issues he's talked about have been issues here in the Valley for a long time when we talk about immigration. I remember being at rallies with members from the ag community, and we're talking about needing workers in the field. And making sure that crops don't go unpicked, that things don't rot on the vines. So I think right now what you're seeing is, I think everyone's trying to see what's real, what's not, what's going to happen, what's he going to do with the new administration in the first 100 days. And I think that's really what, to me, that seems to be the sense, not just among the legislators, but even when I go up and down the ballot.
Yeah, it's not real clear at this point, but it should be in the next few months. But let me kind of switch gears a little bit and talk about some of the more, you know, potentially positive things that could happen when President-elect Trump and the Republican Congress take over. You know, there's some big issues that could impact the Valley. Perhaps something like the infrastructure projects that we've been talking about, water projects or high-speed rail. So I want to ask you, Assemblymember Salas, what your thoughts are on that. I mean, do you think that there could be a room for compromise and maybe getting some of these big projects that impact the Valley, moving them forward?
No, absolutely. I think so. I think there's a real possibility of doing something real on water and water infrastructure. So whether we're talking about temperate sites or any of the dams or the twin tunnels, I think we have a path forward. And I think with the Feinstein legislation and her water bill, and I believe McCarthy's weighed in on it, and Nunez and everybody, so far everybody thinks that's a net positive for the Central Valley and for California just moving forward. So I'm really excited about that prospect and think that we can leverage what the if we can get the federal government to be partners with what the state has done with the water bond and some of the other things we've done to address safe drinking water, I think there's a huge potential because we already have the allocation set aside to do that. And so if we could partner with feds and they're going to come in and they're going to help clear some of the hurdles, I see this as a very positive step moving forward.
Assemblymember Randall, what are your thoughts on this? I mean, you know, high-speed rail, a lot of investment potentially for the Valley. But one of the things that's really stalled that project, frankly, is their expectation of federal dollars. They were expecting, you know, in the range of $20 billion of federal assistance, and that really never came to be. Is high-speed rail more of a possibility with President Trump focusing on infrastructure projects?
Well, I think most of us would hope that in his $1 trillion infrastructure plan, there's room and availability within there to find funding streams to help to support the largest infrastructure project we have going on in America. You know, we have tremendous amounts of opportunities to put people back to work right here in disadvantaged communities if we have a federal government that's willing and able to invest in infrastructure. And I think it's imperative that those of us from the Valley reach out to our federal government and find ways to make it happen. You know, it's our responsibility to make sure that we're working with the administration to make sure to deliver results back in our communities. You know, just yesterday I was at a California Economic Summit in Sacramento where I sat next to Chad Mays, who's the he's the super minority leader. I've never heard that term before, but found it amusing.
But, so he's head of the Republicans in the Assembly.
He is. And, you know, he had some ideas on how to improve CalFresh. He was trying to say if if people were meeting certain milestones, if they had gotten a GED or a high school diploma or a bachelor's, even much further down the line, that, you know, if they were still on CalFresh, he was trying to give them an incentive to get an education. I was able to tell him about a pilot project that we have going on right here in Fresno, something called the Bridge Academy, in the 93701 zip code, and one of the poorest zip codes in the entire state of California, where they're trying to create a pathway for people to get off of food stamps. And they're showing metrics and outcomes, and it's based on real data. And they're in the midst of a pilot study, and they're 4 years in. And because of the results of the study, I hope to be able to work with Chad Mays and Republican leaders within the Assembly to figure out how us as a state can create better efficiencies in government programs. You know, I come from the private sector where it was imperative that we become streamlined so we can maintain our competitiveness. You know, I would like our government to operate in the same way, to be able to improve upon programs and fund programs that are showing to have real outcomes and benefits.
Well, let me follow up on that, because one of the things they're talking about with Medi-Cal and possibly the changes is our block grants, where they would give states a bunch of money and say, you know, you do whatever you think is most efficient and effective. How are you feeling about block grants?
I think it's too early to comment on anything thus far in healthcare. I think we're reacting to things that are coming down the lines. I'm not prepared to go there quite yet. But I am trying to position myself and this office as a leader to be able to speak about how we fund programs in healthcare. I, for too long, think we've focused on treatment and not on prevention and actually keeping disease away. How do we refocus back on healthy eating and lifestyles that will not lead you into healthcare delivery systems, but actually keep you out of them? And, you know, those are the types of things I hope that we can work on over the next years.
Yeah, it's interesting. You're really focusing on efficient and effective delivery of services. And just a shout out, frankly, to the Bridge Academy you were talking about. They actually won an award from the Irvine Foundation as one of the most impactful types of programs in that area. So kudos to them. Well, I want to thank our guests, Assemblymember Joaquin Arambula from Fresno, Assemblymember Rudy Salas from Bakersfield, and Assemblymember Adam Gray from Merced. Thanks, all of you, for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
The views and opinions expressed in the Matter Report are those of the individuals participating in the program and do not necessarily reflect those of the California Channel or the Maddie Institute. If you'd like to share your thoughts about the points and opinions expressed on the Maddie Report, visit our website at maddieinstitute.org.
The Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition, is a public affairs partnership between KMJ Radio, Cumulus Media, and the nonpartisan Maddie Institute, providing the Valley with valuable insight and analysis on politics and important public policy issues. This is KMJ.